Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Drew Deitch. Today we're talking all about the movie The Mangler, which is an adaptation of one of Stephen King's short stories. It sure was something. That was my first impression upon watching it. How about you, Drew? When did you first watch this?
It had to have been back in the early 2000s, maybe even before that. It was just kind of a random video store grab. You know, I saw it. It was based on a Stephen King short story. It was directed by Tobe Hooper. It had Robert Englund in it. I was like, oh, this sounds like a lot of fun stuff. And then I read the back and it's like, oh, it's about a killer laundry press. I definitely want to watch this. This sounds at the very least ridiculous. The reason I signed up to do this one is because this was one of those movies that I kind of stumbled upon randomly, and then it was the movie that I was trying to force all my friends to watch because I'm like, no, you don't understand. Like, you need to see this. Like, this is ridiculous. You've never seen anything like it. And I got one or two friends who kind of got into the cult of The Mangler with me. But I hadn't revisited it probably since then. Like, it was always a movie I kind of remembered fondly for over the top reasons. And I will say, I don't think I've ever read the short story that this is based on.
Honestly, it was one that I barely remembered by the time I got to this. I believe it was collected in his first short story collection, Night Shift. So there was quite a big gap between that book coming out and this adaptation. So even for someone like myself who is going through these things at a much more rapid pace than they were coming out initially, even still, for me, I was like, I vaguely remember this horrible laundry machine story. And I don't mean horrible in the sense that the story was bad, just horrible in the sense that the machine is a horrible thing. And
yeah, I mean, my assumption, having not read the short story, would be that since it's a short story, that the majority of the actual plot in the movie was created for the movie, and the short story is probably like set up around one horrible killing or something. Like, I have a feeling whatever the short story consists of is so minuscule that it's probably in its entirety in the movie, but I have a feeling that so much of the actual plot and mechanics of the story and characters, if there's way too many characters in this movie, I think all of that feels so added on to a story about a killer laundry press.
Yeah, because you're in the laundry facility, you're kind of like, okay, there are so many people coming and going, and at times while watching this, I was like, wait, is that the same girl? Is that a different girl? Because half the time they weren't really using names. Things were kind of just being shouted over the noise of the machine, and sometimes over the noise of the machine killing someone. So you're just like, hold on, I'm getting a little confused here. Which one is his niece? Which one is the one he's like oddly with? And there were so many things that I was just like, okay, as an adaptation of the story, it was fine, you know, but I think they went a little too over the top with it, and it kind of made everything a little muddy as far as the storytelling goes.
Yeah, I agree. I think the story aspect of this is possibly the weakest kind of element in the movie. We know that there's a killer laundry press, which, fine, like, that's your buy-in. That's your ridiculous concept buy-in. If you can get on board with that, which I certainly can. I mean, I can admit that that idea is comical in the extreme, but I'm here for that kind of stuff. And once you get past that, then it's like, okay, well, who are the characters in this story? What is kind of the mechanics of the plot surrounding all of this? That stuff, I think, is either really, really cliched to the point of feeling lazy, or it's all kind of convoluted and hard to pick apart at times, that it drags down the parts of the movie that are both legitimately fun and, I think, unintentionally fun.
Yeah, obviously, Robert Englund at this time is a huge name. So to get him in a Stephen King adaptation too, I was like, okay, maybe something good will come out of this. And he certainly gives this sort of creepy yet over the top performance that we're used to seeing in some of the horror movies that he's done. Obviously, he's not going to top his performance as Freddy Krueger here by any means. And that's something that is certainly going to be hard to do, given that's largely what he's known for. And when you have someone that iconic in that sort of role coming and trying to do a not necessarily similar kind of role, but obviously still in the horror genre, and he is sort of masterminding all of these killings, so to speak.
Yeah, he runs the laundry facility, and there's so many bizarre decisions in this movie. And one of them is like, okay, you get Robert Englund, but we're going to put him under tons of old man makeup. We're going to give him one blind eye and a pair of glasses with one of the lenses blacked out. We're going to have him walk around in crutches the whole movie with leg braces, which at times he looks like he's reenacting the Scarecrow's dance sequence from Wizard of Oz. I think Robert Englund's performance is actually one of the most entertaining things about the movie, because Robert Englund, he is a deservedly important figure in horror cinema, but he's also a very hammy actor kind of in general. And I think he brings a camp silliness to this role that I don't know if it was intended, but I'm glad it's there, because every time his character, Bill Gartley, showed up on screen, I was like, oh, yay, he's going to be ridiculous and be saying ridiculous things. His performance does have some washiness to it, in that sometimes he's putting on some kind of accent. I'm not sure what kind of accent it's supposed to be. This takes place in Maine because it's a Stephen King story, but I don't think he's trying to do a Maine accent. Then other times he drops the accent entirely and is just talking as himself. But he's really entertaining. I will say that casting this movie, as far as kind of a lot of the leads, this is kind of high profile as far as cult genre character actors go. We've got Robert Englund, and then we've got Ted Levine as our protagonist, mm-hmm. the detective John Hutton. And Ted Levine is just such a singular actor. Like, nobody has a style like him. You hire Ted Levine to play Ted Levine.
Okay.
Kind of. And that's what he's doing here, but he gets to be wild-eyed, and he's the, you know, very cliched, beaten down, tired of it all cop investigating this accident of a killing, you know, or what seems to be an accident at this laundry press of this woman getting flattened. And I can't help but laugh, because I think everything surrounding, if I was going to give this movie a big gold star for anything, I have to give it a gold star in the gore effects department, because this movie is crazy bloody.
Yes.
Like, it's to an absurd level that has to know it's being absurd. Like, it's doing this over the top on purpose. And I kind of was giddy every time that laundry press started smashing somebody or folding them up into pieces. I had a big dumb smile on my face.
Yeah, I was really impressed with how well those effects held up, because I was kind of half expecting it to be pretty bad almost, you know, like 10 minutes into the movie. And I was like, okay, no, the practical effects, they totally nailed here. It's obviously the minimal CG stuff that is kind of like, okay, that doesn't look good. Especially that one big scene with the icebox later. And you're just like, oh, okay, that's where we went with that. All right, cool.
Yes, that if a haunted laundry press wasn't enough for you, don't worry. You get two for the price of one, because you also get a demon-possessed icebox. Like, there's a part of me that feels like this is the joke idea of what people think of when they think of a Stephen King story. Like, oh, what am I gonna have, what inanimate object am I gonna have that's haunted this time? I'm running out of stuff. I got an icebox. I got a laundry press. Sure, let's go with those. But, and I'm willing to bet that this is present in the short story. The Mangler's not a movie that isn't devoid of something on its mind. It's clearly about labor and how the machine of labor eats, you know, meeker people up, and how there's a small, select, usually older group of people that are benefiting off the backs of this hard labor, to the point where there's a doorway, I think it's into like the employee locker room in the laundry press area, and there's a saying over the doorway that says, "Labor makes you free." And that was above the entrance to the labor camps at Auschwitz. Like, so
wow.
The movie had something on its mind. Yeah. I give it points for that. I don't think it's what anybody will be thinking about when they actually watch this movie.
No, I think some of the story gets sort of taken away in a sense with this movie, because you're so focused on some of the ridiculous things that are happening. You're like, wait, okay, what is this movie actually trying to tell me? And, you know, not every single movie ends up coming out with a big grand point that they're trying to make. Sometimes it's just, you know, this movie that you're either watching for fun or because it's a cult horror film and it's not exactly saying anything about society. So I think that's where that message gets lost in this movie, because you're so distracted by the other things that are going on. You're like, wait, hold on. What are you trying to tell me here? And did you actually succeed in telling me that?
Yeah, I really wish, because The Mangler is a movie that I kind of want to love more than I actually do love. I wish that the actual storytelling components were better constructed, because there's apparently something going on where this town has been sacrificing parts of itself to this laundry press machine, and in doing so are able to make some kind of deal with a demon, a devil, some force. I don't know. That's never really laid out clear enough, like what it is they're dealing with and how this works. But by doing so, they've been able to remain rich and kind of be the people who run this town. We don't ever see that except through Robert Englund's character. These are all just other people that I guess are kind of talked about. And a lot of this is delivered in, like, at the very end of the movie, with a letter from a character, and a character that I have to talk about, because this is the one bizarre thing about this movie. I can't even begin to justify that. There's a character in this movie who's only credited as Picture Man, who is this younger actor in old age makeup, which is already weird. You're like, what? Why are they doing
just
that?
Just got an old
why
man.
Just hire an old man. Like, unless there's something, like, it comes around in the end, but it's a pointless, like, that's why you did that decision? So this old guy comes up, and he is, like, he's technically the town paparazzo who shows up to all the crime scenes and takes pictures with his, like, 1930s flashbulb camera. This character is a person out of time, like who feels so weird. And really, every time he shows up, it's just to imply that him and Ted Levine's character, Hunton, had some kind of friendship that they haven't really picked up on. But it means nothing to the overall story. No scene with this character ever affects what's going on in the plot.
Right.
You could take him out of the movie entirely and it wouldn't change anything.
And the actor would still be in there as the mortician too. So that's even weirder. You're just like, hold on, what's going on?
Yeah, it's so bizarre. So the whole mechanics of whatever this supernatural deal with the devil plot thing, that never gets put down. But my favorite character in the movie, because he's kind of the most, I don't know, that it's just like a who cares, just do whatever character, is Hunton's brother-in-law, Mark, who's, I think, his neighbor as well, and they're kind of friends. And Mark is this super hippy-dippy, believes all this supernatural stuff. And he... he immediately, after Hunton like tells him like, oh, there was this accident at the laundry, you know, facility, immediately Mark is like, well, do you think it could be a demon? Like he doesn't hesitate immediately. And then he kind of gets, he tags along with Hunton when they're like talking to different people, and he's clearly just, you know, always asking inappropriate questions and stuff. And he's so just immediately bought in to like, nope, yep, I know it's demons, and I'm just going to spout all this stuff about Belladonna and the Hand of Glory and how we have to recite this. And everything with Mark is so silly to me that I again, when him and Ted Levine were sharing scenes attempting to get exposition across to the audience, but it never worked, I just enjoyed how kooky the character and also the performer, the actor, Daniel Matmore, I think is just kind of let loose in a really fun way.
Yeah. On the note of the characters here, it's interesting to me because, you know, when you look at IMDb, most people will have a picture, but for this movie, most of the people actually do not have a picture, and Daniel Matmore is included in that, which is weird because he's definitely been in enough things to have a picture on IMDb, but it's all the women who do not have pictures. And I was like, oh, that's interesting, because when you think about it, none of the women are really instantly recognizable in the way that someone like Ted Levine or Robert Englund is in this.
Yeah, I mean, my assumption is they kind of blew their casting budget on getting at least two recognizable names. Also, this was shot in London and I believe South Africa. So my assumption is that laundry set, the actual interior that we spend the most time in with the giant mangler device, which I do have to, I mean, they had to build that thing. It's impressive. It's an impressive physical object that's part of the set. So I kudos to them. I'm assuming that interior was in South Africa, and a lot of those actors were potentially cast around there, because there's also a lot of dubbing. I think his name might be Stanner. He's kind of the foreman of the laundry press.
Yeah.
Like walks around and yells and stuff. His performance is completely dubbed over. So I believe he's probably a South African actor and had just a really strong accent that they had to dub over.
Okay.
But yeah, I do appreciate the big mangler device. I like the sets, and I like how tactile a lot of the movie is. I will say, I don't think this is a poorly directed movie. It doesn't look bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those things where I was watching it, and it was more so that I got bored with the story than I got bored with how the movie itself looked, because it was well done as far as making this machine very intimidating. Like you said, it was very well built. It was massive. So just seeing people standing next to it, you're like, okay, this is a big, dangerous thing if anything goes wrong. And obviously things go wrong. And then, you know, maybe it didn't look so good when it came apart and started chasing after people. But, you know.
Well, once it turns into a giant CGI monster with, I think there's even one shot where it turns to the camera and it has a big red eye.
Wow. Yeah. I missed that. I was kind of zoned out by then. I was like, oh, here we go.
But yes, that sequence where they think that they're trying to exercise the machine, which I love, because it's just two people yelling for a whole scene at a big inanimate object. And then they're like, oh, no, I guess the antacid pills that Ted Levine has been taking have Belladonna in them, and they got into the machine when it killed the old lady at the beginning, and that's why it can turn into a CG monster that runs around and claws at them with a gear hand and all this stuff. I mean, the CG on that is regrettable, but they start running through the facility, and they go down, and it looks like it's suddenly this huge cavern, this like weird temple or something. It's so nutty.
I was just like, where is this? Is this in the facility? Like, what's going on here? It almost looked like they were running down the steps of like this giant castle or something, and you know, they're in the turret and they're just kind of going down these winding stairs. And I was like, wait, where is this? We're in a warehouse. What are we doing? What's going on? And it was one of those things where you're like, all right, you're just gonna have to run with this and you'll worry about it later.
Well, all that kind of stuff, the settings and everything, I think are pretty impressive, especially for this movie, kind of, I'm sure, the lower budget effort that it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think Hooper does a lot of good stuff with the locations that he's able to use, even in small moments. For example, there's a point where Huntin and Picture Man are having a conversation and they're both kind of going up or down opposite staircases in this one little corridor, and there's blue light coming down from it. And it's like, you made this really kind of bland looking location because of the angles you shot it at and the relationship between the characters and the lighting. It's like, this looks pretty cool. So I don't think the movie is poorly directed at all. I wouldn't even say it's poorly acted. It's got over the top actor. I mean, I feel kind of bad for Vanessa Pike, who I think she gets the introducing. This was kind of her introduction. I don't know how much more she did, but she is the niece, I believe, yeah, of Robert Englund's character, and it's her virgin blood that has brought the machine to life after she cuts her hand on it. And she is pretty much only asked to cry to the point of hysteria every scene she's in. Like, if she's in a scene, she's crying, and she's not just like crying, she is at a 10 weeping uncontrollably or screaming madly, yeah, in every scene she's in. And I'm like, man, I can't imagine how wiped out you must have been after every take,
especially if she had to do multiple takes for those scenes, because you're just like, oh my goodness, I'm getting exhausted and I'm not even the one in hysterics here.
Sure. And then she has to deal with, she's almost always the recipient of some fake blood getting splattered on her for some reason. I'm like, man, I feel so bad for this actress because this is all she's asked to do. So I like the actors in the movie. I think they're either doing things well intentionally, or they're doing things fun maybe in unintentional ways. I mean, there's a part where somebody, I think, is getting burned by a pipe that comes off and burns some of the women, and Robert Englund is up at the top of this like scaffolding that overlooks the laundry press, and he just starts dancing with his crutches. He's like, I'm gonna do a dance for you. I'm like, what is this? This is so bizarre. So I like all that, but as we keep coming back to, I think the main culprit of this movie is that you have an over-the-top idea like a killer laundry press. You could build out from that. You could just stick to that. Mm-hmm. I think the movie could be fine without all of this, oh, there's a piece of me in the machine and a little bit of it in me, and you have to make a deal. Here's a contract that's signed that you can be super rich and powerful here in this town with some kind of deal. I think that could almost all be jettisoned, and it could just be that for whatever reason, be it the blood of a virgin or something, brought this laundry press machine to life, and now it's folding people to death. Because everything else outside of that is just either not interesting or not properly communicated.
Right. What did you think of the little twist at the end there where the niece takes over the facility and is acting exactly like her uncle?
Again, I can't help but laugh.
Right.
Because it's like, it's another one that was like, what? It's so off the wall that my immediate reaction is to laugh at it. I mean, I could put on my professor hat and be like, well, this is showing that the wheels of capitalism can't be taken down. And, you know, it's that kind of thing. But it's like Ted Levine's reaction to that moment, because he walks and he has these puny little flowers to bring her and he sees her acting like Robert Englund's character, and then cut to his reaction shot. And he's just, because he comes in and he thinks that, you know, the machine fell down this giant pit when they were escaping it and it's been destroyed. Mm-hmm. He comes in, he sees it's business as usual. It's back. And his reaction shot face are just, what is going on? It's pretty much my reaction shot at the end of that movie, where it's like, what? You know what? Screw this. And he just leaves. And I'm like, you know what? I'm with you, Ted Levine. I'm like, whatever. Let's just go. Let's get out of this movie. We're done.
It's almost like every reaction that he had was exactly what the audience was feeling. And I love when there's a character like that, because you're just like, yes, this is us. This is how we feel.
Yes. I'm right there with you. It's unfortunate because I looked this up, and of course, it's very negatively reviewed. And I understand why. And some of that is deservedly so. But the things that are good in The Mangler are surprisingly good.
Yeah.
Like, the entertaining performances are really entertaining, and unlike anything you'll see in a lot of this kind of arena of low-budget horror filmmaking, I really think, with the exception of the unfortunate CG Mangler monster at the end, I think all of the effects work is kind of stellar. I really think it's that good. And I think the movie has kind of a fun stupidness to it that you can vibe with. But you can't hope for any real explanation or story that's going to make sense. And in fact, it might be better going into this movie to just accept the confusion as part of the experience and be like, yeah, you're going to be confused and it's ridiculous. Like, try and enjoy that, because this is not going to make sense.
Yeah, I was probably a little harsh with my rating on it. I ended up giving it a 2 out of 5. And I think that's just because I lost interest during the movie. And I was like, oh, this is an hour and 45 minutes, give or take a few minutes. I was like, oh, you know, that kind of feels a little too long in the grand scheme of things. So I definitely wanted to give credit to the effects and the directing, though. And I do want to note that this was directed by Toby Hooper, who is a repeat customer with King adaptations. He did the Salem's Lot adaptation, the very first one. So all the way back to, what was it, like 1979 for that. And he had done stuff. He had done an episode of Freddy's Nightmares, an episode of Tales from the Crypt. So he was really ingrained in the horror world, and that's sort of where his bread and butter lie. And I think he is someone who, his stuff does have negative reviews like this, and, you know, Salem's Lot wasn't the best thing, but given the time, I think Salem's Lot was actually pretty good for what they were able to accomplish, it being a TV miniseries kind of thing and all. But I think, you know, it's one of those things where, like you said, the direction and the effects were the standouts in this.
I would say those are legitimately good aspects. Like, they're things that people shouldn't overlook about the movie. The performances, I think they're camp, and that's kind of something that varies from person to person, how much you're willing to dig into that and find it enjoyable, or if it's too nonsensical or too over the top for you. But I enjoyed Robert Englund and Ted Levine and the actor who plays Mark, Daniel Matmore. As a kind of lead trio of characters, I found them kind of really ridiculous in fun ways. And sometimes I think they get that in the performance and they lean into it. Sometimes I think it is completely out of their sphere of influence, that they're just doing things that they don't know is being kind of silly. But the overall story is just jumbled and way more complicated than it needs to be. For as complicated as the actual story and mechanics of everything are, it's much simpler than it appears to be. It just has the illusion of complexity, and there's nothing ever really interesting. As much as the characters are fun, they're never interesting. Like John Hunton, there's this whole thing about his wife died in a car accident or something. there's no real emotional buy-in to any of the characters.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big detriment. But I would still say if you like kind of crazy over-the-top effects, if you like bizarro movies as far as their plotting or their kind of initial premise, I think The Mangler is worth checking out. As far as in the greater canon of Stephen King adaptations, this is definitely way on the lower rung.
Also not the worst.
Yeah, I think it's bizarre enough to merit mentioning. I don't think it's worth totally forgetting.
Yeah, and there are some sequels to come. I don't know if I am covering both of them. I will have to consult my spreadsheet on that, but I know there's at least two after this. And it's one of those things where sometimes I feel a little less inclined to cover some of the sequels to things just because I know they don't have anything to do directly with the Stephen King stories. People were just like, oh, this was a good idea. Let's continue it, but in our own way with our own story that's not necessarily pulling from any of his short stories or novels per se. It's just kind of taking the idea and going in a bit of a different direction with it, which is probably why I don't think I'm going to cover Creepshow 3 either, or the 800 other Children of the Corn movies. But
yes. Yeah, I've never seen the Mangler sequels. I've never had it, but I know the second one is like, it's like a college campus's security system that gets possessed by an energy demon.
Interesting.
And so that's kind of the only connection. And then the third one, Mangler Reborn, is actually about some guy purchases the Mangler from the first one and he ends up getting consumed by it or something. But he ends up being a zombie and or like a living corpse or something. And the only way he can stay alive is to feed victims to the Mangler. I've never seen them. I've never kind of heard anything really noteworthy about either of them, good or bad, to kind of be interested in them. And the reason I don't think I've checked them out is my fear is that neither of them can live up to the simple effects pleasures of the first movie.
Okay.
That's the stuff I'm like, yeah, I would recommend The Mangler. If you're like a gore hound, like if that's something you like about horror movies, you really want to see good practical gore effects, you need to see The Mangler. Yeah. Like there's some incredible stuff in it.
I totally agree, but I think, you know, that pretty much wraps up our thoughts on this movie. I know it's a little bit of a shorter episode, which can happen sometimes with some of these adaptations. You're just like, I have these thoughts on it, and that's sort of it. And, you know, I think you enjoyed it a little more than I did based on the performances and everything like that. But overall, like I said earlier, it's not the worst Stephen King adaptation. I think, you know, I ended up giving something half a star one time. It might have been a Return to Salem's Lot. So
yeah, I'll be interested when all's said and done with this show to see what in your opinion was the worst one you had to watch.
That could make for a good bonus episode towards the end here. And I know there are so many King adaptations in the works that it's going to be hard to ever really finish this podcast. But, you know, sure. Once I get through the majority of stuff and I'm up to date, I'll probably do, you know, a little ranking of, you know, some of my favorites and then least favorites, because you can obviously tell which films are the top tier films because they're the ones that everyone sort of agrees on. You know, you're always going to have your Shawshanks and your Green Miles in there for the adaptations when you're talking about some of the best ones. And you kind of can tell which ones are going to fall towards the bottom of the list once you start talking about things like, you know, the Children of the Corn sequels, Return to Salem's Lot, the ones that, like I said, aren't necessarily about anything that Stephen King wrote in particular. They were just kind of like, oh, let's expand on this and call it a Stephen King adaptation. So it's one of those things where I kind of struggle with, should I cover this? Should I not? And, you know, we'll figure it out as I go here. But Drew, thank you so much for coming on to talk about The Mangler today.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I'll be the lone voice in the wilderness, kind of sort of going to bat for the Killer Laundry Press movie.
Works for me. Before we go, I quickly wanted to let you all know about our Patreon. You can support this podcast for $1 a month or $2 a month. For $1 a month, you'll get a thank you on the show. $2 a month, you'll get a Chat Cemetery sticker. Those are limited. So if you want one, definitely sign up at the link in the show notes. You can find us on Twitter at Chat Cemetery and on Instagram and Facebook as well at Chat Cemetery. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.